Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I'm your host. Earlier this year, new clinical practice guidelines for pregnancy care were published and are available on the Department of Health website. One of the authors of those guidelines, Professor Caroline Homer AO, is with us today to talk about those guidelines and what changes to clinical practice they recommend. Professor Homer's co-authored guideline summary is available at mja.com.au. Now, the article you're publishing is a guideline summary about the updated clinical practice guidelines on pregnancy care. When did those new guidelines get published?
These are, as you say, the updated version, and they were published in about March this year.
What's the change in the structure of the guidelines themselves? I know they were originally two different modules, weren't there?
Yeah, so when we first started the guidelines back in 2008, we brought everybody together and had this incredibly long list of things that needed guidelines on in relation to pregnancy care. We didn't have enough funding in the beginning to do everything. We had to prioritise. So the first module that was published in 2012 is really first visit antenatal care. A few other things got thrown in there, but mostly it's what happens at the first visit. Then we got a little bit more funding. Did the second module in 2014, and that was some more things around ongoing pregnancy care. And then last year we got some more funding, which enabled us to pull the two modules together.
Great.
So that there weren't two things that people had to look at, and there were one module, and we updated a few aspects that were controversial at the time.
Let's talk about those. There are four key recommended changes to practice. The first is to test for hepatitis C at the first antenatal visit. Why is that a change that needed making since the guidelines were put together?
In 2012, when we did the guidelines, we recognised that hepatitis C was an important infection. But one of the principles around screening is that you have to be able to do something with the findings.
Yes.
You have to be able to offer something. And with hepatitis C at that time, all there was we could offer was knowledge that you had hepatitis C to pregnant women. Subsequently, the new drugs have become available and are now on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. We now know that you can actually cure hepatitis C with these new antiviral drugs. And so we thought it was really important that women had an opportunity to know their hep C status, but they can't be treated in pregnancy. We don't know that these drugs are safe in pregnancy, but opportunity for once their pregnancy is over for them to start treatment. We still know that people are undiagnosed across Australia with hepatitis C, and so yes, pregnancy is a fabulous moment to test all sorts of things. You have to be careful that you don't go overboard and test everyone to such a degree that they're terrified. We certainly recognise that hepatitis C is a really important infection to be able to then manage the infection or the disease later on.
Now, vitamin D, good old vitamin D, which seems to go through cycles of popularity and not being quite so believed in. Your new recommendation is not to recommend vitamin D supplements during pregnancy. What's the thinking behind that?
Over the last probably 10 years, vitamin D has got incredible enthusiasm across Australia, and particularly in pregnancy. So we know you can test women for vitamin D and that many practitioners will then provide supplementations or will recommend that women take supplementation. There are some services across the country that then treat their babies once the baby is born with supplementation. Suddenly we have this epidemic of treatment for vitamin D deficiency. Mm. The interesting thing is that research has not strongly shown that treating makes a difference. Many women are deficient, but we're not convinced that actually doing something about it will make a difference. And we're not convinced that it might not do harm. So this is to try and temper the enthusiasm across the country for vitamin D screening. We have in the guidelines put the sorts of women who should be screened, so particularly women who are dark-skinned, who are covered, who don't go in the sun. There are certain groups that should be screened, but for everybody else, we're saying do not screen. It is not necessary. And this is actually an interesting example of trying to stop clinicians doing something rather than get them to start doing something.
Your third key change is for clinicians to discuss weight change, diet and physical activity with all pregnant women. I thought that happened already.
It does to a certain degree. There are concerns across the country that we are stigmatising women when we talk to them about their diet, when we weigh them, when we discuss BMI.
Right.
And so in many services, midwives and doctors are unwilling to have the conversation. So often we say, you know, you're not eating for two, keep care of your diet. You know women put on X number of kilos depending on what their original BMI was. But we're often uncertain about what to say about diet, what to say about weight, and what to say about exercise. This part of the guideline was trying to reassure clinicians that actually doing exercise when you're pregnant is a good thing, mm-hmm. and might actually have some benefits, and that discussing weight with women throughout pregnancy is important. We were concerned in the previous guideline that the more women were weighed, or if they were weighed, that would cause them distress. There isn't good evidence one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And when we put this one out for consultation, there was a lot of enthusiasm from clinicians to go back to the days of weighing, which is when I trained, we all weighed every woman at every visit. So because the evidence isn't strong, we've got a sort of a middle ground, what we call a consensus-based recommendation, that offers women the opportunity to be weighed mm-hmm. when they come to their visit, and then encourages a conversation about it. It's not a recommendation that all women must be weighed, but
yeah.
it's part of the conversation you have in an antenatal visit.
What's the thinking these days about how much weight a woman should put on during pregnancy?
Look, the guidelines that we still use are based from the US, and they're based on what the woman's initial BMI is. So if her BMI initially is high, then we encourage her to put on less weight. So if her BMI is low, then we encourage her to put on more. So the average is probably still around 12 kilos according to the guidelines, but we think most women put on more than that, and perhaps that's not such a good thing.
What about those women who just, no matter what they do, can't put on weight, even when they're pregnant?
That happens, and certainly in low-income countries and in women from low-income countries who migrate to Australia, often we see that. And in women who don't eat well or not being able to afford a healthy diet. So that certainly we see that. Sadly, in Australia, we see more of the opposite end. Women are finding it difficult to maintain a healthy weight, and certainly after the baby's born, find it very difficult to lose weight, and so often enter the next pregnancy heavier than they were the last time.
My guest today is Professor Caroline Homer, AO, who is Co-Program Director of Child and Maternal Health at the Burnett Institute in Melbourne. She is also Visiting Professor of Midwifery at the University of Technology, Sydney. What's the message you want GPs, say, to take away from these new guidelines, Caroline? What do you want them to take away from it?
I guess the important thing is that recognising that for most women, pregnancy is healthy and well,
yes.
and that all women are excited about their pregnancy. So we need to temper our enthusiasm for testing and screening and finding things wrong with encouraging the woman and supporting the woman to enjoy her pregnancy. So there's always that tension, I think, in antenatal care.
Sure.
There are some tests that we really should now be offering, some of the genetic screening tests around early ultrasounds and making sure we work with women to make sure we know when their babies are due, because that's important not only now but at the end of their pregnancy when we're thinking about induction. Critical areas. Also, psychosocial issues in pregnancy. I think many of us have focused so much on the tests and the things that we can do with women, the tests, the blood pressure, the screening tests. We're now knowing that psychosocial issues, social and emotional issues are absolutely critical. These guidelines highlight the importance of perinatal mental health screening and also asking about domestic violence and safety that women are going home to. One of the biggest contributors to maternal death in this country is suicide, and we know that we have a domestic violence epidemic. So those areas, often we forget. We're probably quite good at the list of tests, but we're not so good at the thinking about the social and emotional context. I think for many GPs, they're really good at this because they know the family.
Yes.
They know the story. They know the backstory. They've been seeing the woman before and after her baby. So mm-hmm. often GPs, I think, are actually really good at this. I think we're less good at it in big public hospitals or big private systems where we don't know the women over time. We don't see them the same people every visit. So that's a really important area.
How do you ask those questions?
The time factor in busy clinics, both private and public, is certainly a problem. I think I think in the systems that many of us work in, where we don't see the same women over and over again through pregnancy, is also a problem. Where you can embed continuity of care, so women see the same practitioners, midwife or doctor or both,
yes,
throughout their pregnancy, it's much easier to ask these hard questions. It's really hard to ask them cold when you've got a 15-minute consultation,
yep,
and you're never going to see this woman again. So
yeah,
if you've seen her two or three times and you notice things, you know, she's looking a bit sad today or things aren't looking as good as they did last time, it's really easy to ask about mental health and to ask about family violence.
If you had a magic wand, Caroline, is that what you'd fix? Would you make continuity of care more of a priority?
We didn't specifically look at continuity of care in these guidelines around a sort of a broad package.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly know from other research and from just practical experiences that continuity of care will make a difference, will help practitioners and women. We have got quite a big section in the guidelines around migrant and refugee women and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women,
yes,
and the importance of providing culturally appropriate, culturally safe care. Again, that can happen in non-continuity of care, but it's always going to be better when you know the providers and you know and the providers know the women. While continuity of care is not a specific recommendation in the guideline, certainly weaved in throughout, that I think it will be easier for people to provide quality antenatal care if they know the women they're looking after.
Are there enough healthcare workers in antenatal care?
That's a good question. We don't really know that, to be honest. We don't keep data about the workforce providing separate aspects of pregnancy care,
right,
labour and birth care or postnatal care. So we don't really know whether there's enough. We know that in many public antenatal clinics there are often waiting lists or it takes a long time to get in for the first visit. Recommendation is to have that first visit early in pregnancy, but I know of public health services around the country who the woman might have seen their GP and received the referral, so it's great that she's had that entry-level care, but to get into the hospital system, she may not get in until 16, 17 weeks. Unfortunately, the GPs can order and be involved in most of the early care, so
mm-hmm,
that's very helpful. But I think that's indicative of stretched services and possibly not enough services. But
yeah,
as the guidelines, we didn't look at that specifically, and we
sure
don't really have national data on that. I think for me the critical thing with pregnancy care is to be focused on the individual woman in front of you. So what's her needs? Where is she at in her pregnancy? What's important to her today and what's going to be important to her at the next visit? And always couching the tests that we recommend or the screening that we recommend in a recommended fashion. So it's not a mandated fashion.
Yeah.
And we need to actually make the time in our clinics to be able to provide women with the information they require. Hopefully having these guidelines now publicly available, and there will be some other resources online over the next 12 months,
right,
it means that women can then access the information as well, and
yes,
providers can then send women off to find their own information that if they want additional information. Focusing on the person in front of you and, you know, what does she need today and what's going to be useful for her at this point in time, and perhaps not bombarding women with everything at every
mm-hmm
visit.
Where can they find the full guidelines?
So the guidelines are available on the Health Department website. I think if you just Google Pregnancy Care Guidelines Australia, there is now for practitioners, and on that page there's a web version, so you can access it on your phone or
cool
on an iPad. The online version for mobile devices will be really helpful for people, particularly busy GPs,
yep,
and other primary care providers working in the community.
Thanks a lot for your time, Caroline.
Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.